Sounds like you home-brewed it. Was that part of the original design? And what is the stated impedance ratio for that balance, if you happen to know, Dan? KB2FBU, K2LIW.
Yeah, again, this is information that I don't know, the state of the impedance on the balance itself. But you're right, it does, the second wire comes back down to the coax. And also, the one side of the ladder line is an extended counterpoise. So I don't know if both the coax and the ladder line are acting as a counterpoise. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say thank you for the help and the feedback I've gotten from you guys, but I really feel like I need to do some more homework. And I'm going to look at this week. This has kind of inspired me to climb up there. And I'll come back next week if I still have any more questions. Otherwise, I'll let you know. I'll let you know how it goes. But I don't want to take up any more time. I'm really interested in hearing about the SpaceNet, and I know there's another question out there. So I really do want to leave it. I know people are probably going to want to come back, but I'm going to drop, and I'm going to listen. And thank you, Dick, and thank you, everybody else. KD2FBU, listening.
Good luck with that project, Dan, and I guess we'll be hearing from you next week or the week after. Ed, K2GJE. And how are those electrons treating you, Ed? And what would you like to talk about? K2RIW, the TechNet.
K2RIW, and the net. This is K2GJE. I think the question might be for Eric. Commercial AM stations, they used to be allowed to overmodulate. I don't know if they still are. And if they were overmodulating on positive half cycles only, how did they accomplish that with not overmodulating on the negative half cycles, which would turn the transmitter off and give you all kinds of spurious signals? Over.
Yeah, if a standard broadcast station is allowed to overmodulate, boy, that sounds unusual to me. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
RWK2J. Oh, that's an interesting question, actually. There is an old set of rules that actually on positive peaks you're allowed to go to 110-115%. But generally, that's all done by an audio processor. With IBOP now, and a lot of AM stations actually transmitting digital on the sidebands of the main lobe, and that concept of overmodulation. The whole idea is to make your station loud, well, louder than the next guy, so that way you wound up with more listeners. It's not overmodulation per se in terms of if you were looking at the RF coming out of the transmitter, that you would see a segment there where there's no RF because it's so loud. It's not like that. Peak audio is really what we're talking about here. But with the advent of the digital IBAC format, you can't do that because then what happens is you splatter all over the place. So that's sort of a thing of the past. K2RW, K2J.
I vaguely remember in the early days of ham radio, back in the 60s, 70s, where people were using amplitude modulation by way of modulating the screen of a tetrode tube, and they had some kind of exalted or enhanced modulation where the upward voltage was allowed to, on peaks of audio, allowed to go higher than the negative swing, and therefore you wouldn't have cutoff. So there was some kind of a upward modulation technique being used, and so a person looking at his signal strength meter while listening to that signal, you would see a certain amount of S-meter deflection, and when the guy talked, you would see the S-meter go up a little bit on this exalted modulation. Those are my words for it. I wonder if that rings any bells with you, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Actually, this would be good for one of my friends who actually takes care of a whole bunch of AM transmitters. Yeah, basically, sort of like that, but done not at the RF point, it's actually the input to the modulator. Again, that's something that's a little bit in the past. Actually, there's some really old Collins transmitters that a lot of the guys would modify them, and then, of course, they'd have to get it, do another proof of performance on the transmitter, which would allow them to, in essence, do what you're talking about there, whereas when there would be peaks of audio, you would see more RF coming out of it. But there's a limit to how much you can do that before you start to actually clip the audio, because you wind up with little holes with no RF. If you were looking at a sine wave, you would see a blank hole with zero crossings in terms of the amount of RF coming out of the transmitter. That actually never happens, but what they do is you wind up doing the peak modulation, producing a little bit more output, and allowing it to collapse down to its normal carrier level without making the carrier level disappear.
Okay, great stuff. While I've got you, Eric, I'm going to bring to your attention the January issue of Microwaves and RF Magazine on page 38. Actually starts on page 37, an article entitled Five Technology Areas to Watch in 2017. Anyhow, the Ethertronics company is talking about building fancier antennas because they're predicting a whole lot of people are dropping off of their cable service because they're using other kinds of streaming.
You're talking about 5G.
Yes and no. Is this really 5G? A lot of people are dropping off cable. The prediction is that in 2017, you can expect around 24 million non-paying TV households. That's what we're going to have, 24 million non-paying TV households, because people are using other techniques for getting television reception. Over-the-air television reception, this company, Ethertronics, is now coming up with fancier antennas because they know an awful lot of people who are getting over-the-air television are going to be forced to use a household antenna, an antenna in the house, because landlord restrictions and whatever won't allow them to put one on the outside. And they're building an adaptable antenna where you can steer the beam and steer the polarization in order to be able to tolerate the multipath you get inside of the house. You're still getting good digital television reception. So the fact that they're building an adaptable antenna, let me drop this.
You don't remember our conversation from 3 or 4 years ago, do you?
No, I don't, but you're going to bring that back to my attention. But the one of the most significant things here was 24 million.
Repeater, timeout.
24 million non-paying TV households. That's almost a quarter of the American population is going to be using over-the-air television. So give me information on all of the above, Eric. K2EJ, K2LIW.
RWK2J. Well, before we get there, I wanted to ask you, did you get channel 33?
You're talking about what advertises itself as 33 or really RF frequency 33. Advertising itself as 33 right now, no. I'm getting 31. Yes, I am getting 33. Yes, I am. I've got about 33-1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 10, as I remember. So I'm definitely getting 33. Over to you, Eric.
33-1 is me TV, right?
Roger, Dodger.
Hold on to your hat. That's VHF channel 3. And there's a story that goes with it. But I just wanted to let you know, because you didn't think there were any channel 3s anywhere.
You're telling me that my sneaky tuner has been going over to what advertises itself as channel 33 UHF, but it's really lower VHF channel 3. Wow. And I do get some occasional crazy dropouts. Now I understand why. If any impulse static is coming locally, that's going to interfere with that. Where's that channel coming from? Is that Empire State Building? Over to you, Eric.
That comes from the Condé Nast building, or 4 Times Square, which is much lower than the Empire State Building is. And also, if you watch Channel 25, which is actually 24, that's also coming from Carmenan.
I definitely watch Channel 25-1, 2, and 3. CUNY TV is 25-3, and they've got a lot of very good programming. So that's also coming from Times Square. How about that? They must be running a good amount of power for me to get such a nice, clean signal on both.
2 kilowatts.
Only 2 kilowatts. I'm getting a nice, clean signal for them on both 25 and 33. Both of them are only 2 kilowatts. They must have a darn efficient antenna. Over to you, Eric.
That's one of the good natures of digital television. Anyway, yeah. Now, I forgot what you asked me. I'm sorry.
Okay, the Epatronics company is predicting that in the year 2017...
All right, I got it. There's a guy by the name of Chernok, who used to work for Boeing, but he's now actually the head of the ATSC. He's a really smart, interesting guy. I think it was about... You remember we were talking about something that Disney put out, and it was called Movie Beam. Do you remember that?
Is this one of these so-called wireless cable TV things up? Eric, go ahead.
I think of it as like 10 years ago. Movie Beam was a digital subcarrier that we put on the analog portion of Channel 21 and Channel 13. And essentially, it was a form of QPSK, and he had developed an active antenna which later was made to work for digital television. Basically, it connects to the tuner of the TV set, and it does several things. It monitors the equalizer. I think the new ones that they're talking about actually have that whole circuitry within the antenna itself, so it doesn't have to rely on the tuner of the TV. And what it does is it adjusts the taps accordingly to however the antenna is pointed. And if you remember, we were talking about third generation and fifth generation equalizers. We're on seventh or eighth generation equalizers now. And the big deal that makes it work is the concept of pre-ghost. Remember that conversation?
Now, this Epatronics adaptable antenna has a number of beams and a number of polarizations, and it does tap. It does tap into the tuner to know which one is giving the best performance, which I guess is the lowest bit error rate. And now this pre-ghosting thing, is that I guess a real good rake receiver recognizes the signature, so to speak, of the multipath and can tune itself so that the multipath, they can get rid of the ghosts that would have been there on AM so that you're not getting into symbol distortion. Is that sort of what you're discussing, Eric? K2RIW?
That's correct. The concept is whichever arrives first, and essentially the equalizer, if you can think of the equalizer as a comb filter, where each one of those symbols occupies a certain physical space in the time domain. And essentially, it says, okay, I'm going to extract the IMQ at this moment, and each bit time that comes by is when I'm going to decode IMQ. And don't forget that the DTV signal itself has a pseudo-random number sequence, so that's what gives you that nice Nyquist flat-looking thing. And because the symbols occur at very specific times, based upon which group of symbols are coming in that you're going to decode. So if you happen to have a multipath signal that's actually arriving earlier than the main path signal, what it will do is the equalizer will shift in time for that particular signal, or shift the other way. So the amount of microseconds of these new equalizers is much broader than it used to be, and you have a much better chance of not only picking up the signal, but locking onto it, and even being able to follow it while there's some atmospheric disturbance. It's RIWK2J.
Now, what may be related to what you're discussing now, Eric, is something that I vaguely remember as a transversal filter. If I've got a delay line with a whole bunch of taps, and if I can take each of those taps and adjust the amplitude and phase angle before I put them into a summing circuit, I can now take a multipath signal and essentially do echo cancellation. I can make everything line up, each of the individual paths that have different time delays from the transmitter to my receiving antenna, I can make them all line up if I adjust that filter correctly. Is the modern day equalizer, can it do some of that function, KE2EJ, adaptively, K2RIW?
K2RIW, K2EJ. We do it all mathematically. We actually don't do it with tuned circuits. Actually, what we do is we take a segment of RAM, and what we do is we calculate the coefficients that we need to pass that stream through, and that's dynamic. It can move in time. It can also deal with amplitude changes and a whole bunch of stuff. And the new stuff is more interesting than the old stuff.
So you're digitally creating both time delay and feedback paths, if I understand correctly. So you're doing a kind of multiple echo cancellation or multiple echo correlating is what I think I would call it. Is that sort of what's going on here, Eric? K2RIW?
Go with correlating. There's a number of helpers that get us through that, and that's knowing where the sync byte is. There's a certain sequence of numbers that come by, and when it detects that, it says, okay, this is where my timing starts. So we're really looking in terms of time as opposed to taking the part that we think that shouldn't be there and inverting it and adding it so that it removes it. There's problems with that when we're doing digital symbols.
So I think you're saying that ultimately the system recognizes the individual time delays of the individual paths and manages to line them all up with a time domain filtering function is what I think you're discussing, Eric, go ahead.
That's correct. There's been some experiments done with trying to deal with it spatially, but they run into problems with that. But, you know, think of it as a shift register in it. Bits that you're rolling in, you know, that you could, in essence, slide that shift register in time, make it, you know, a couple of nanoseconds earlier, a couple of nanoseconds later before we capture it and hold it in the D-latch before we read it. That's sort of a simple way of trying to make a picture out of it.
Now, part of the reason I'm bringing this article to your attention, the thing that amazed me,
oh, by the way, the magazine's on my desk. I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, 27 million non-television paying households. In other words, 27 million households in the United States are predicted in the year 2017 to be getting purely over-the-air television. That's one quarter of the households in the United States.
No, that's not a quarter of 330 million.
330 million is the population. That doesn't mean 330 million households.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry.
I'm guessing there's roughly 100 million households, and if 27 million of them are getting over-the-air television, some time ago you were predicting on one of your negative statements that over-the-air television is going to disappear. Everything's going to be cable, and cable and satellite.
What I was saying is that the past FCC was doing everything they possibly could to make TV go away, and they're still doing it.
But if 27 million households, which is more than a quarter of all the households in the United States, are going offline and they're going to get over-the-air television reception, boy, not only because of all the history of over-the-air television in the United States, but the fact that many are doing it, my goodness, are they going to be protesting? They're going to be protesting almost as much as they're protesting with Trump right now.
There's more.
So over the air is going to live forever as I see it. Over to you, Eric. K2RAW.
Let me give you the quick rundown. Now, most people in this country aren't aware that the FCC on the Communications Act of 1936 provided for the public airways. The public airways, meaning free. Okay. Congress decided that, oh, we can make money by selling frequencies. So they started this auction, actually at the beginning of the summer, where they were going to sell 108 megahertz worth of bandwidth to the telco companies. And the concept was is that the profit that the government would make would be something like $15 billion, and they would have to also come up with another $1.75 billion to repack all the TV stations that will remain on the air, because it's still undecided whether the low powers and the non-Class A stations would just simply go off the air, and that would be the end of it. So there's that. Actually, we're now down to, I think, 60 megahertz, because the last round of auction, and by the way, it's the sixth round, where they've actually come up with, the telcos have come up with enough money to meet the demand for frequencies. What they've discovered is that all of this, like, we don't have enough bandwidth, whereas the telcos didn't want to spend the money to get that bandwidth, which means that they basically have enough, because, let me let it drop, that in the previous auction, where everything above 55 was sold, got gobbled up by the telcos. So now it's gotten down to a smaller thing where if this auction actually makes it to the end, the government will wind up with something like $3 or $4 billion, and they'll also have to come up with the $1.75 billion to repack the TV stations. And what that means is that they're going to move. If you happen to be on Channel 21, you might have to join with 25 and transmit your signal along with their signal on the same carrier, which means, in essence, that you're going to have less resolution or less data rate for your pictures. Enter ATSC 3, which is coming next year, and it's actually being implemented in Korea now. It is a non-compatible form of QAM. Don't forget, we're currently transmitting BSB, and we're now going to COFDM. And that is where they will be able to transmit 4K and other kinds of services, you know, HDSB, which is a high-definition, an ultra-high-definition video format, and also high-resolution, not high-resolution, what am I looking for? I'm looking for high-dynamic range, thank you, HDR. Which will run at about 35 megabits, 40 megabits through this particular method. So what that means, and let me let it drop again, that you're now going to start packing your television signals into a SD format, and one RF carrier will probably have 10 or 12 or 15 video carriers on it. They're going to look really horrible. And that will happen as the ATSC 3 transmitters come online. So the public is in for a real whacket. K2RIW, K2RIW.
When we were being told about advanced television, high-definition television, digital television, that all went together, so to speak. If Channel 21, which right now has Channel 21-1, 2, and 3, must combine with Channel 25, and there already is a 25-1, 2, and 3, that means the combination will be 25-123456. Therefore, there'll be limited
metal. You maintain your PSIP, so you keep your identification.
Okay. How do you squeeze that all onto the same carrier without losing resolution? I mean, the whole reason for going over to digital, that is, was advertised so the public would accept it, is it's high definition. Are we going to go back down to a lower definition, Eric? Is the public going to scream and holler about that?
Okay, well, there's two ways of looking at it, okay? There is resolution, and there is the ability to update the picture in a certain period of time and minimize the number of artifacts. Okay, if I'm going to stop, you know, nine channels, well, first of all, let's talk about 21, for example, whereas 21-1, which is the HD output, and that runs at about 12 megabits a second. 21-2 and 21-3, they run about 3 megabits per second. So, the concept is that you've got 19.39 megabits in which to play with. So, what can you do? You can either go and not transmit high definition and do standard definition with the current MPEG decoders that are in the TV set and have pretty reasonable 16x9, 525 kind of pictures. Or, you can lower the bitrate and keep the high definition, but slow down the refresh rate and suffer with artifacts. So there's a number of different choices that can be made. The public, in essence, will hate all of them.
If you lower the refresh rate, isn't that really lowering the frame rate? I mean, you're not going to get 120 frames per second. You're going to get some much lower number. And if I'm watching the movie Grand Prix, where you've got a whole lot of high-speed automobiles moving real fast that are being being tracked with the camera, but the background is going to smear like crazy. So if I'm watching the movie Grand Prix with that system you're now describing, I might become a bit unhappy. Is that true, Eric? K2LAW?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, there's a spatial response to the picture itself. You wouldn't see it necessarily as smear, because you would be refreshing the picture. Don't forget, your picture's coming out of a chunk of memory, so whatever the native display of the display is, it will keep going. But the idea is that I will write less frames per second, and by the way, it's not 120 frames per second. That number that you're talking about is when you're dealing with the refresh rate of liquid crystal, because, you know, they decay. But if you've ever gone to the movie theater and you know the stuff is shot at 24 frames a second, it's being projected at 48 frames a second. If the camera moves quickly or if something moves across the screen quickly, it doesn't necessarily smear, stutters. It takes jumps between one position to the next. And as you slow the frame rate down, the distance between each picture will be that much larger. It'll, you know, we can get so slow at like 18 frames a second where it looks like old time movies. So, again, there's a number of different ways to spin this thing, and going less always looks worse than going more.
Yeah, the old movies at 24 frames per second flashed at 48 per second.
That's what we get in a movie theater. 18 frames is the old rate.
But that gives you some funny stroboscopic effects. When you're watching wagon wheels turn, sometimes the spokes look like they're moving backwards because of the stroboscopic effect. And I think you're saying that that effect is going to become more enhanced with what you're now discussing. K2LAW?
Yes. But interestingly enough, technology marches on when the companies that are making coders improve their filtering algorithms and basically take all that stuff into account. And if you remember in the old days of color TV, when you were fixing a, let's say an RCA CCC2 that had a 22AXP22 in it, with the metal bulb, literally, you always had the problem of chroma coil. And that happened before they decided to lock the horizontal and the color oscillator together and divide down instead of to from 60 to 5994. That's a whole other story of mathematics, but that made a huge improvement in terms of what the color picture looks like and the chroma coil issues that you would get. You look on a current analog TV set, if there was an actual current analog transmitter somewhere, you would see that there is no chroma coil. You might see the displacement of the dots along an edge, but they didn't move. So, in essence, the newest algorithms of the encoders do an absolutely marvelous job of making a nice, fluid-looking picture, standard definition, 525, that runs at a half a megabit. You look on the internet, and you're looking at stuff that might be 128K, 256 kilobits, not even megabits, when you're watching YouTube or something like that. And they're not using MPEG 2, which is an older system. They're using MPEG 4 or H265, which has more layers of creating coefficients. And because they're all discrete cosine transforms, whereas in MPEG 2, a macro block is like 8x8, and in various different forms of 862, the macro blocks are 16x16 and 32x32. So when you actually see those pictures break up, you get big square chunks of the picture missing.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You've used the word chroma crawl a few times. If I knew what I'm looking at, if I'm watching something with chroma crawl, what will I see, Paul? I mean, Eric.
In the old days of analog NTSC, when RCA developed the system, you would actually see along the edges, let's say you have a face, since you're looking at it in two dimensions, there's an edge to the edge of your face. You would actually see the color dots running down or up, depending on which way the frequency was off slightly. I'm not talking about Moiré, which is another mathematical function which is different. You know, when you see a guy with a checkered tie, you see all these Moiré lines on the tie. Well, that also has to do with the dot structure, but it's a different animal. We were talking about 1955 to like 1960, where the color oscillator ran strictly off the burst and it was not referenced to the horizontal plane.
Does that mean the 3.579545 had to be tuned to a slightly different frequency to sync it to the horizontal sync so as to stop the chroma crawl? Was that what was done?
No. What was done was we would actually start with 14C1818, which is
Yeah.
And we would divide that down and derive the 358 from it, and we would also derive the 15736 from it.
So that means everything is therefore synchronized and locked, and therefore nothing is crawling. But before that, there was this incompatibility between the chrominant signal and the luminant signal. Is that what you're saying?
Two separate oscillators. This was before what we now call RS-170A.
If I understand you correctly, that problem was cured in the 60s, is that true?
Actually, it was really cured in the early part of the 70s once we stopped making stuff out of tubes. Because all of those dividers, you want to do it with tubes, it's a real pain. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen early, like RCA TK42s, those kind of cameras, or TRT1 or even TR70, which is a 2-inch quadruplex machine. The color oscillator was a separate oscillator from the oscillator that was deriving the sync and the vertical sync.
So that's why Walter Cronkite was very unhappy about during the Kennedy assassination. They had to get a camera warmed up in a hurry in order to make that emergency broadcast. And I guess those cameras in those days had a zillion tubes and a significant warm-up time for all those oscillators to settle down to give you a high-quality broadcast picture. Is that roughly true, Eric? K2LAW?
No, it wasn't so much the camera as it was getting a remote signal and trying to make it synchronous. CBS had developed a box where they literally sent a tone over the phone line, and that would in turn baselock an oscillator at the remote truck site to try and get those sync generators to run at the same rate. Now, once they ran at the same rate, they manually had to phase them in so that they could actually put it into the switcher and phase between the local source and the remote source.
When it comes to electronic news gathering truck out in the field, I can see how you've got that problem. He was trying to get a camera warmed up and established right in his office, so to speak, right at his desk, in order for him to make a emergency transmission concerning the Kennedy assassination. So the documentaries that occurred about that event showed you that he had a lot of trouble getting a camera dedicated, moved into the right position, warmed up and whatever, in order to make those famous words that he said. Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
Correct me if I'm wrong, this was in the black and white days, right?
Roger, Dodger.
Yeah, okay, I don't remember what kind of cameras they were using back then, but let me tell you a little story about Marconi cameras and Crystal Palace, which was it, their broadcast. they actually had the floor marked with a compass. So when they would line up the camera and the image off the con, there were a lot of knobs to adjust on that thing. They would literally point the camera north because the local magnetic field, the Earth's magnetic field, would affect how you adjusted the camera. I think it was, I don't know, if they were using RCA cameras, like an RCA, what was it, 2K11 or 2K21, it'd be like 45 minutes before the camera was ready to go, between letting all them tubes warm up, and you had two racks of tubes behind the camera, and you also had the I.O., they used them as Orthicons in those cameras in those days, the 5820. That's a camera that has a target and a set of dynos in the back, which is connected by a photomultiplier. The electrons that would bounce off the target would be collected by the photomultiplier in the back, and then see how you generate the video. So it would take, you know, a good half hour or so, and then another guy another 15 minutes to align it before it was ready for use. That's probably what you're talking about.
Eric, do you have wind blowing across your microphone? There are times that the wind sound is almost equal in amplitude to your voice sound. Over to you, Eric.
Sorry about that. You don't hear that now, right?
Roger, Dodger. Was that an open window?
No, it's just a heater. I'm outside working, so I'm sitting in the car.
Okay. There's a lot of wind blowing across that microphone. Is what it sounded like. So, we've come a long way when it comes to solid-state circuitry in a modern-day camera. Some of these cameras are super small compared to, I guess, some of those old black and white cameras. They looked to me like they were 150 pounds and contained about 50 vacuum tubes or something like that.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I used to rebuild RCA TK-42s, and you needed a crane to put the damn thing on a pedestal because it weighed about 420 pounds from what I remember. And that was without the lens, without the glass. No, I actually have a 4K camera. That's about the size of, smaller than a pack of cigarettes, so. Yeah, we've come a long way. Actually, the new security cameras are high definition, high resolution. And it's amazing what we can do, but it's really all because of LSI's, the whole ability to put an entire literary TV studio within a chip.
Sounds like you've benefited a lot from Moore's Law, where I guess the number of transistors doubles every 18 months or something like that in a chip these days. Time we go over to the space report. We've kept held Paul off for a long enough period of time. WS2N, you've got it, Paul. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Don't worry about me. I'm learning as we go along here. Very good. WS2N for the base portion of the TechNet, number 237. And, we'll go over the papers that you sent me, which were very good, all about the Russian space program from years ago. In a couple of minutes, let me just go through this. I just want to, before I do the space portion of the net, on last Monday, you know, you listened to the club InfoNet, and at the end they have Newsline. And one of the statements there was they're working on a solution for the Great South Bay to apparently keep that antenna in the Marriott Hotel on Exit 58 out here near me in Montgomery. And that's the one that we talked about. They're going to turn that into a casino. The earlier reports were they're going to do away with it, but apparently must be some discussion going on for them to make that statement. Let me drop it.
Got a last comment.
Is that Eric?
Yeah, just in relation to the space report, since we were talking about cameras, the moon camera that they used on the LEM, that was color, was actually a Westinghouse camera, which was a single Vidicon and had a color wheel in it. And it didn't actually, they actually had to use a standards converter back at NASA to convert it to standard television to show you how far we've come. The Great South Bay problem, there's actually more to it than a lot of people know.
Are you able to give us any of that information, Paul? Because somebody, I should know who, sent me an email saying that on the TechNet we should be discussing the Marriott Hotel repeater removal possibility, and maybe we can help them. Over to you, Eric. KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
It's not my place, Dick, so I really should have said what I said, but it's just something that I know. Sorry.
Okay, you've got a bolt.
Okay, and yes, all I'm going by is Newsline, which, by the way, is very good that the club has that on every week. I listen to that almost every week whenever I can get a chance. Oh, yeah, I know you can get it online and different repeaters, but, you know, we always have the InfoNet, and then we have the Swap and Shop, and then followed by Newsline. And they have some good space stories in there relating to amateur radio as well. So, we always talk about the commercialization of the space program. SpaceX and Boeing and Bigelow and all these different companies that are involved in it. And it turns out Boeing now is one of the companies that are building the Starliner, which will eventually carry four people to the International Space Station, probably starting in 2018. But they're coming along and they're developing their own spacesuits. So, That's always a big change. Instead of using the spacesuits that NASA has developed, and the ones that they're developing for the Orion, so they came out with that. I saw what that looked like, and very lightweight, only probably about 20 pounds. The boots are incorporated with the spacesuit. The helmet itself is incorporated. You don't need to have a separate helmet attaching to it separately. Very comfortable for a ride in their Starliner.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Will be May or April, probably May of 2018. And SpaceX, I still think is going to beat them. I think they'll have an uncrewed flight by the end of this year if things go good. Now, SpaceX is developing their own spacesuits. We haven't seen them yet. They haven't come out with that. Let me drop this WS2S. Another topic we cover quite a bit is not only our own space program, but what's going on in the rest of the world. And China is still one of our competitors when it comes to the space program. You know, they're trying to outpace us and Russia. So, you know, we have quite a few competitors. And they have now announced another flight to the moon, unmanned, but this November. And they plan on sending a sample return mission. All their missions are called Chang. You know, they started off with Chang 1, 2, 3, 4. They're working their way up. I guess this will be number four. And they plan on landing on the front side of the moon and take some material from the moon, put it in a rocket above the spacecraft that they landed with, and use that as a platform, take off, and go back up to I'll call it the mothercraft that's orbiting the moon. Dock with that, and then fly back to Earth. And they have a heat shield and all, and they'll land in the Gobi Desert. That's where they land, you know, all their flights. So they're coming along, and I mean, not to be outdone, you know, we have here in America, we have private launches also going up at the end of the year that plan on landing on the moon. Probably two from the United States, and maybe two or three from different countries. And they're competing in the Google Prize. The Google Prize is going to hand out total parts of $30 million. I think it's $20 million for the first place, probably around $10 million for second. And that, and those kind of numbers. I think there's a third place, too. But they've been trying to do this for like the last 10 years, and the deal was they had to get off the launch pad or at least have a contract by the end of the year. So some of them might make it by the end of 2017. I think Moon Express will probably be one of them. And they'll land on the moon at the end of this year, just like China. The difference is China wants to bring something back. These companies plan on landing there, taking HD picture, transmitting it back, and then with either a rover or some kind of mode of transportation, they plan on moving at least 500 meters away from wherever they land, and then doing that again, taking pictures and sending them back. If you do that, you get $20 million. Now, some of these companies have put more money into this program than $20 million. So it seems like a loss, but they'll, you know, get the bragging rights, and they'll continue on with future flights. Their goal is to really develop the moon. Let me drop it. So that's some of the competition that's going on with China and Russia. They all, you know, ourselves. And now you have your European Space Agency. They just launched a Soyuz rocket from French Guiana a couple of days ago. French Guiana is in the northern part of South America, near the equator, only a couple of degrees, I think 4 or 5 degrees off the equator, north of the equator. So they got a big push for geosynchronous flights. And Soyuz has gone off from French Guiana many times. I believe this is the 16th flight. But this is the first one for Soyuz to put something into geosynchronous orbit. They've kind of like upgraded it a bit to be able to do that. I mean, they had an exact 1 second window to do it, and it went off fine. And they put this satellite to Brazil successfully into geosynchronous orbit. The interesting thing is that they have plenty of rockets that go off from that launch facility in Kourou, French Guiana. They have a lightweight rocket vehicle, medium, and heavy. Light one is Vega, built by Italy from the ASI, the Italian Space Agency. And then they have the medium one, which is Soyuz. By the way, Soyuz has their own Russian crew down there. It's a deal, really, between Russia and European Space Agency. You have a heavy lift vehicle, Ariane 5, which has flown probably, I don't know, I think 70 or 80 times at least over the years. And that's the one that's going to be launching James Webb Space Telescope for us in 2018. So that's what goes on in you know, for the European Space Agency, and not too far from us down in South America. So we do have a flight coming up this week, Friday, another Falcon 9 flight. They just a couple of weeks ago successfully launched the return to flight Falcon 9 from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. They sent up 10 Iridium satellites, and they're all functioning, which is good. I mean, they're really a communication satellite, but also they're going to be receiving signals in the future, probably starting around 20, I don't know, maybe a year and a half or so. It should be functional. You have to get all these planes to have the equipment on board. What they plan on doing is having every airplane, plane going, you know, transcontinental and ocean flying airplanes. I think there's, you know, I forget how many thousands of flights, you know, per day. But they'll be able to track them. They'll be transmitting from the planes automatically, you know, with information, metadata, you know, dealing with what plane they are, their flight, their course, and all of that. This way, if any plane is ever lost at sea again, they'll be able to know exactly where it went down. Unlike now, you know, they have a tough time tracking these airplanes when they're out in the middle of the ocean, you know, lack of radar capability. And it will also lower the cost of all these flights, because now you could have a tighter separation between the airplanes without worrying about, you know, one running into the other. They can go off their main course. They say they don't have to necessarily stay exactly where they are. They can go either further south or north if they're going to Europe or something. So you're going to be able to put a lot more planes in the sky. They won't have to worry about as much fuel for problems that that would have normally possibly occurred. They'll have a better idea of fuel consumption. So this is all because of the Iridium satellites and launched by SpaceX, Space Exploration Technology, actually the name. I keep saying SpaceX, but that's the name they use. And they will now have another flight flying out of Florida this Friday. Drop it. It's called EchoStar 23, so it's heavy, very heavy satellite going into geosynchronous orbit. And because it's so heavy, they have decided not to try to recover this booster. I think something like the last 7 boosters have been successfully recovered by the SpaceX team, either on land or on these autonomous ships. But in this case, they are not going to do that. It will be an expendable rocket because of the weight. They will not have enough fuel to get back to a drone ship. So, but they say predict that this will be the last one to do that. In the not too distant future, they have another upgrade to the Falcon 9 will be the last one, they said. So they'll be increasing the thrust and the amount of fuel that they can handle for those Falcon 9 rockets. So even if they were launching the same exact satellite, say a year from now, they would have enough fuel to return to a autonomous barge ship out, 400 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean. So that's the story with SpaceX. Let me drop it. All their flights are shown. They have a webcast. If you go to SpaceX.com or the SpaceX webcast.com, you can bring it up. And they're pretty good. They have engineers talking, giving you more information than I could probably give you. Although I've gotten a lot from them. So not sure I could use it on future nets. One other topic is the HTV 6 has departed from the International Space Station. That's a cargo vehicle from Japan. It's capable of bringing almost 10,000 pounds up to the space station. It docked with the space station about 6 weeks ago. It successfully brought up six lithium batteries, and these are big batteries. You know, each one is probably the weight of a piano, around 500 pounds or so. And then they replaced 12 nickel hydrogen batteries that were attached to the space station. It's a 2-to-1 ratio, so they're able to take 9 of these old ones stick them back into this cargo ship, the HT, the sixth cargo ship that's flying from Japan. You know, take out the new batteries, install them, which they did successfully on two EVAs, and then have the old batteries be replaced back into the cargo vehicle. And because there's more of them and bigger and heavier, they couldn't do them all, so they're leaving three attached to one of the truss sections of the space station. And they'll stay there somewhat permanently for the future. But the other nine are being sent back on the HTV to be burnt up over the Pacific Ocean. But before this vehicle burns up, they have one more test that they're going to do. And they have a satellite that's going to be lowered or with a tether type of thing. 45-pound satellite from this cargo vehicle. They're going to lower it down, and then they're going to take readings, see if they can get voltage readings. This type of thing has been done before, but they would like to experiment with it. Japan will, because they have big future plans of using this type of thing for eventually attaching to space junk that's flying around. They'll be able to use the magnetic field for converting into electricity to actually slow the pieces down, you know, from their 17,500 miles an hour, whatever they're going, eventually slow them down and be able to deorbit these pieces. So that's a long-term plan for Japan, and this is just, you know, one of the tests. And then after that, they'll just deorbit the HTV into the Pacific. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. I just want to go over this. It looks like about 20 pages that Dick sent to me regarding the Russian space program going back to 1995. Came out of the IEEE Spectrum pamphlet or magazine that they have. And I'm glad you sent them, because it's interesting to compare and see the differences between what they thought was going to go on and what was going on in 1995 compared to all these years later, 2017. And this, you got to remember, this was only about, four years after the end of the Soviet Union and their development. Like, you had the Russian Space Agency was called RKA, and it's pretty much called Roscosmos now. That's the name you always say. Drop it. They're the main players in the Russian Space Agency. Main player used to be Energia. Energia is the one that built the Bond space shuttle, their own version of our space shuttle, which only flew once, unmanned, but went to orbit around the Earth. Eventually came back, and they landed it successfully. But that was it. They had long-term plans for this thing, but from reading this article, it looks like Russia had a lot of money problems back then, and probably still do now. Definitely had money problems. They had the Mir space station in orbit. International Space Station wasn't up yet until the first piece was flown toward the end of 1998, 1999. They started really connecting pieces. They set the functioning cargo block up end of 1998. We set the Unity module up, dock with it using the space shuttle, and from there it progressed. Some 30, 40 flights later, you have an international space station after quite a few years. It was really like 11 or 12 years of development. But back then you had the Mir. And the Mir would have cosmonauts on board, and at one point they decided to bring up American astronauts. As this thing was written in 1995, they'd only brought up one, and it was
Norm Faggett went up with the Soyuz. Here he is on board this thing called the Mir spaceship. The Mir space station. By the way, Mir stands for the word peace. But this thing was completely built differently. First of all, the diameters of the entranceways were a lot smaller.